Pasadena Playhouse presents The Visit, a haunting, twisted, and truly grotesque comedy starring Tony Award winner Jefferson Mace and Mad Men's Melinda Page Hamilton. When the richest woman in the world returns to her struggling hometown, she's ready and willing to rescue it from ruin, on one condition. Experience The Visit at Pasadena Playhouse beginning September 9th. Further information and tickets are available at pasadenaplayhouse.org and kpfk.org.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM in Los Angeles and on the web at kpfk.org, Pacifica Radio for all of Southern California and beyond.
It's Thursday, September 3rd. I'm Scott Baba. Vice President J.D. Vance downplays the conflict in Iran.
I wouldn't call it a war. Right now, there is no active shooting. I recognize there have been places where this has flared up.
More details on the United Nations report that says we have already blown past the carbon target set to prevent the worst ravages of climate change.
This summer, scorching heat, raging wildfires, and deadly floods are a warning of what lies ahead. Every fraction of a degree will cost lives, destroy livelihoods, deepen inequality, and push ecosystems closer to irreversible damage.
And the U.S. House of Representatives passes a new bill that would punish American schools and students over boycotts of Israel.
Don't let anyone convince you that this bill is about anti-Semitism or even just about Israel. The bill's language is written to include Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank. It is in defense of an illegal act by a foreign government. And the victims will be American students.
These stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Scott Baba. The Trump administration is trying to keep the U.S.-Iran conflict from escalating before November's midterm elections, even as fighting has resumed and Vice President J.D. Vance says he cannot predict when the conflict will end. During the first White House press conference since the departure of former press secretary Caroline Leavitt, Vance told reporters today that he would not call the situation a war.
I wouldn't call it a war. Right now, there is no active shooting. I recognize there have been places where this has flared up.
Vance also declined to say whether the fighting would end before the November 3rd elections and deferred responsibility for the ongoing conflict onto Iran.
When you ask, when will this end, you're asking me a question like, when will the Iranians stop shooting at ships? I think the reality is, I don't know the answer to that question. You would have to ask the Iranians. When will the Iranians shooting at ships stop having an effect on world energy markets? And the answer is, it has less effect day by day. So what we're going to do is not depend on the Iranians behaving responsibly or negotiating in good faith. What we're going to do is use the tools that we have at our disposal to ensure that the American people, one, never have to deal with the threat of an Iranian nuclear program, and two, that world energy markets are properly supplied.
The conflict has political and economic consequences for Republicans defending narrow majorities in Congress. A Reuters Ipsos poll found just 31% of Americans approve of the war, while 63% disapprove. Trump's overall approval ratings has fallen to 33%, according to the same polling. Meanwhile, Reuters reported that senior Trump aides, including Vance and Secretary of State Marco Rubio, have argued in favor of keeping the conflict relatively quiet until the election. The administration is instead currently emphasizing sanctions and economic pressure on Iran. But the strategy faces challenges. The U.S. has continued striking Iranian targets near the Strait of Hormuz, while Iran has retaliated against the U.S. and its allied targets. Vance also said today that the administration is investigating reports that a U.S. strike hit a wedding celebration in southern Iran, killing and injuring civilians, though he said he was doubtful of those reports.
The Iranian state media has not been a very good scribe about what's happened in the conflict thus far, so I'm extremely skeptical of this. What I can say with 100% confidence is that unlike the IRGC, the United States never targets civilians in combat. We never will do that. We never have done that. And unfortunately, obviously, sometimes things happen. But in this particular case, I don't think that we have any information one way or the other. We're investigating it because obviously we care. We want to know. And if we do make mistakes, again, this is a big difference between us and Iran. When our military makes mistakes, they learn from them to try to get better from them. So we're investigating it very fully.
Analysis of images and video by Reuters of the damage found it was likely caused by a direct hit from a U.S. munition. The Pentagon said it is investigating the incident. Meanwhile, Vance offered no timeline for the conflict to end or for gas prices to return to pre-war levels. A Lebanese man held prisoner in Israel was released today in the first such handover since the latest Israel-Hezbollah war began 6 months ago. The International Committee of the Red Cross said Malik Ghazi was transferred to the Lebanese army after being handed over by Israeli authorities at the border. Israel says it has agreed to release five Lebanese civilians detained in southern Lebanon after Lebanon helped search for the bodies of Lebanese Jewish leaders who were abducted and killed during the country's civil war. Lebanese officials expect the other four prisoners to be released by tomorrow. The U.S. State Department said the release resulted from U.S.-led mediation between Israel and Lebanon. Lebanese Prime Minister Nawaf Salam thanked the United States for helping secure the deal. The release comes as Lebanon and Israel struggle to implement a U.S.-mediated agreement calling for an Israeli withdrawal from southern Lebanon and the disarmament of Hezbollah. Another round of talks is expected later this month in Rome. Lebanese officials say dozens of people remain detained by Israel, including both Hezbollah fighters and civilians. Venezuelan opposition leader Maria Corina Machado is pushing back on President Donald Trump's oil deal with Venezuela's interim government, saying the country's natural resources don't belong to what she called an illegitimate regime. In her first public comments since Trump announced the deal, the Nobel Peace Prize winner said, "We still do not know the full scope of this agreement, who is signing it, what exactly is being signed, who is putting up the money, who is providing the guarantees. How will this benefit the Venezuelan people? These are legitimate questions, and understandably, this announcement has raised profound concerns about what it could mean for the future of our country. But the wealth beneath our soil does not belong to an illegitimate regime. It belongs to the Venezuelan people." She added that her supporters feel sadness and anger at being excluded from the negotiations, though she stopped short of directly criticizing Trump, saying, "Of course, the United States is the principal partner Venezuela needs to fully develop its strategic potential. That is what most Venezuelans believe. It reflects the values our two countries share, and it is something I have defended throughout my life. The enemies of the United States in Venezuela are sitting in Miraflores Palace today." The deal involving more than 65 billion barrels of Venezuela's oil reserves was struck with interim president Delcy Rodriguez, who took power after former leader Nicolas Maduro was removed by U.S. special forces in January. Trump had been expected to back Machado as the new head of Venezuela, but instead sided with Rodriguez. Two major Moscow airports halted operations for a second consecutive night due to drone threats shortly after Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky warned airlines and insurers that Russian airspace poses a growing risk to civilian aviation. Russia's aviation authority, Rosaviatsia, imposed temporary restrictions at Vnukovo and Sheremetyevo airports Tuesday, saying, quote, temporary restrictions have been introduced on the arrival and departure of aircraft. The previous night, three Moscow airports were disrupted, with Sheremetyevo logging 21 cancellations and 235 delays, and Vnukovo recording 22 cancellations and 94 delays. Zelensky said earlier this week that Ukraine plans to intensify long-range drone operations inside Russia in response to continued Russian strikes on Ukrainian cities, warning commercial airlines to factor that risk into their operations. In a post on social media, Zelensky said, quote, it is from Russia that the first missiles and the first drones came, and they crossed our country's border from Russian airspace. This escalation cannot and will not remain confined to Ukrainian territory. Ukraine's foreign ministry has formally notified the International Civil Aviation Organization that Russia's airspace poses growing dangers and is pushing the body to urge member states to bar civilian flights from Russian airspace entirely. Turkey's Pegasus Airlines turned back several Moscow-bound flights mid-air and canceled dozens of other overnight amid the disruptions. Russia says it will close German cultural centers in the country, retaliating after Germany shut down Russian diplomatic and cultural facilities amid growing tensions over the war in Ukraine. Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said today that Goethe Institute centers in Moscow, St. Petersburg, and Yekaterinburg will close. Yesterday, Germany announced that it was closing the Russian consulate in Bonn and the Russian House Cultural Center in Berlin, following Germany's accusation that Russia was behind an attempted drone attack at Leipzig-Halle Airport last month. The explosives-laden drone was found near a Ukrainian aircraft and was later defused. Western governments have increasingly accused Russia of carrying out sabotage, cyber attacks, and disinformation campaigns to undermine support for Ukraine. Moscow denies the accusations. Meanwhile, President Donald Trump said today he plans to ask European nations to repay the United States for past military aid sent to Ukraine, while also signaling a temporary halt to weapon sales to allied countries. In a social media post, Trump wrote, quote, we are taking them for ourselves, the USA, rather than selling them to others, but the sales to allies will soon again begin. He added, quote, hundreds of billions of dollars was given to Ukraine and NATO free of charge that Europe would have paid for if they were only asked, but we will be asking for that money, though somewhat belatedly. He blamed the Biden administration for the earlier arrangement. The comments follow reports that U.S. munition stockpiles have been significantly depleted amid the ongoing Iran war, raising concerns about military readiness. Trump said the U.S. is ramping up production. Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent separately pointed to Ukraine's strikes on Russian energy infrastructure as a factor driving up global oil prices, telling Fox News, quote, we are going through an energy shock right now due to both the war in Ukraine and then the conflict in Iran. Oil prices hit six-week highs today and renewed tensions in the Strait of Hormuz. Canadian Prime Minister Mark Carney announced a $4.7 billion investment today to build more than 300 new Via Rail passenger cars in Thunder Bay, Ontario. The first time in four decades, the cars will be made in Canada instead of the United States. The project is expected to support nearly 700 jobs and comes as Canada pushes its Buy Canadian policy amid an escalating trade war with Washington. Shortly after the announcement, President Donald Trump accused Carney of making him, quote, the enemy for political gain, posting on social media, quote, it is very good for Canadian politicians like Prime Minister Carney to make President Donald J. Trump the enemy. Until their economy collapses, then it will prove to be very bad for politics, worse than anything that has ever happened to a Canadian politician. Just watch. Carney defended Canada's decision to walk away from trade talks with the United States.
The most important thing we can do is not to spend all our time waiting by the phone, waiting for a call, looking at, you know, refreshing on social media to see what's coming across. No, It's building. It's building here. It's building bold. It's building now. It's moving forward. It's making those connections, those trade connections, interconnections. And it is talking to and concluding agreements with all of those countries around the world who want to deal with Canada.
Canada plans to impose new tariffs on more than $20 billion of American goods next week in response to the latest U.S. tariff hikes. A United Nations report says nations are shooting past the climate goals set by the Paris Climate Agreement, and that means the world is in for decades of extreme weather, water shortages, hunger, and extinctions of species like coral. The report, called Limiting Overshoot, sets out a new aim, limiting the length of dangerous warming and bringing it back down by the end of the century, all while trying to increase adaptations to minimize some of the harm. Christopher Martinez reports.
Plan A to save the planet has not worked out, so now it's time for what will be a costlier and deadlier Plan B. That's according to a new and rather bleak report from the United Nations Environment Program, or UNEP.
Humanity is speeding past the limit to avoid climate catastrophe.
Antonio Guterres is the UN Secretary General, and the limit he's talking about to avoid climate catastrophe is 1.5 degrees Celsius above pre-industrial levels. That's the limit on warming that nations agreed to in the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement. But the UNEP report says passing that limit is now inevitable.
The latest report from the UN Environment Program delivers a stark warning. The world is failing to keep that promise. We are set to breach the 1.5 degree limit within the next few years. And this summer, scorching heat, raging wildfires, and deadly floods are a warning of what lies ahead. Every fraction of a degree will cost lives, destroy livelihoods, deepen inequality, and push ecosystems closer to irreversible damage.
Inger Andersen is director of the UN Environment Program.
Well, let's face it, the planet is sending us some signals, and they're coming rapidly with great intensity and frequency. Flooding, fires, landslides, calamity all around, impacting people and planet and our economies. So we have to take action. We have to do more, not less.
The UNEP report is called Limiting Overshoot, Navigating Exceedance of 1.5 Degrees Celsius and Pathways Towards Return. The key words there are pathways towards return. It means since we failed to hit the target from below, now we'll have to suffer the overshoot and try to hit the target from above by lowering emissions. Or as Andersen puts it, we need to talk about a decline pathway back down to 1.5 degrees.
Now there are no good outcomes if we remain above 1.5 degrees centigrade. So we must hold fast to our commitments under the Paris Agreement and try to turn to below 1.5 by the end of the century and adapt to the impacts of climate change. So even if we exceed 1.5, let's be very clear, 1.5, that 1.5 target is still the goal. And that means that we have to work to keep peak warming as low as possible, as the peak itself as short as possible, so that we can bring temperatures down.
The report says the overshoot, peak, and decline pathway is the best option remaining to minimize the amount of warming and how long it lasts. The pathway includes immediate and sustained cuts to greenhouse gas emissions, bringing down temperatures through long-term net negative emissions, and removing carbon from the air. It also includes adaptation actions to reduce the impacts of climate change, though there are limits to adaptation and some impacts will be irreversible. But even if this Plan B works, it still means the world will be in the overshoot period for many, many decades, according to report co-author Richard Betts. The report says, in the best-case scenario, warming will peak at 1.8 degrees above pre-industrial levels, followed by a gradual cooling, hopefully by the end of this century. In the words of the report, if we act now, we can limit overshoot, not a safe world, but safer than remaining above 1.5 degrees for the long term. That phrase, not a safe world, alludes to a number of harsh realities. During the decades of overshoot, the report says more people will die, food production will drop, people will go hungry, water shortages will worsen, economies will be hurt, and species like coral will go extinct. It also warns of other irreversible tipping points, such as the loss of the Amazon rainforest and the shutdown of the Atlantic Ocean circulation system that keeps much of Europe warm, and some places might become uninhabitable. As for bringing warming down from the overshoot, Secretary General Guterres says we can still bring it down below 1.5 degrees by the end of the century.
That demands an overshoot of ambition, accelerating the phase-out of fossil fuels and renewables revolution, slashing methane pollution, and protecting land, forests, and oceans.
In order to carry out that overshoot of ambitions, Guterres says governments will need to deliver on national climate plans, net zero commitments, and more. And he says developed countries must triple their financing of adaptation measures and make sure that funding reaches those most at risk. That's a big ask from countries that have already failed to meet their original commitments under the Paris Agreement. But Guterres says it can be done.
The science is clear. The solutions are at hand, and the world has never been better equipped to deploy them. Now is the time to raise ambition and accelerate action. The fight for 1.5 degrees is the fight for humanity, and I thank you.
Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
The Trump administration filed an urgent appeal with the Supreme Court today, seeking permission to immediately implement new U.S. Postal Service rules for mail ballots. The move came just hours after a hearing in which a federal judge appeared likely to extend an injunction against the rule change, when federal lawyers failed to convince her the post office is ready to implement the new system for handling mail ballots, just one day before states began sending them to voters. During the hearing, U.S. District Judge Indira Talwani repeatedly asked a Justice Department lawyer whether an online system designed to track mail voters was operational. Yet the lawyer could not provide a clear answer and instead argued the main issue was whether Talwani had the legal power to stop the rollout. The system would require states to upload lists of voters requesting mail ballots. The Postal Service would then compare those lists with information on ballot envelopes before mailing them. Talwani said she had seen no evidence from the Postal Service showing how the system would work, calling it an experiment ahead of the midterm elections. Talwani is considering whether to extend an order blocking the Postal Service from acquiring the system through September 10th. In June, she prohibited the administration from implementing Trump's executive order for the November election, ruling the changes came too close to voting for the federal government to embark on such a project. But the Supreme Court ruled that Talwani's order was premature because the Postal Service had not yet published regulations governing how it would apply Trump's order. The agency then did so just before the High Court ruling came down, prompting Democrats and voting rights groups to swiftly refile their lawsuits. They won an initial victory with Talwani's 14-day restraining order, which the administration has already appealed. Trump has long opposed mail voting and falsely blames it for his 2020 election loss to Democrat Joe Biden, even though he often uses that method to cast his own ballot. Voting rights advocates counter that the president has no authority to set election rules, which is a power designated by the Constitution to the states and, in some cases, to Congress. Meanwhile, election officials say there's simply no way they can comply with the Postal Service directives, which could require a complete overhaul of their operations. Before it delivers mail ballots for any state, the Postal Service would have to approve the design of the envelopes that contain them and have the state upload a list of voters receiving them to an online portal. But most election offices have already printed their envelopes and ballots, and some ballots have already gone out. A few municipalities in Wisconsin opted to send mail ballots to voters earlier this week, but tomorrow marks the full kickoff of voting as North Carolina starts shipping its mail ballots to all voters who requested them. The Trump administration has contended the changes are relatively minor and legal, but the portal was still not active as of this week. A whistleblower report released earlier this week warns the portal's implementation has been rushed and flawed, and bugs in the system could prevent millions of ballots from being mailed if errors occur in large batches. A federal judge has blocked President Donald Trump's latest attempt to limit birthright citizenship, granting a preliminary injunction against the executive order that the administration said would target birth tourism. U.S. District Judge Deborah Boardman in Maryland issued the injunction yesterday until a class action lawsuit brought by immigrant families and advocacy groups is resolved. Birthright citizenship is guaranteed under current law for anyone who is born on U.S. soil, with a few exceptions. The law stretches back to 1868, when the 14th Amendment was ratified in the aftermath of the Civil War. But Trump has long wanted to end the practice, issuing a previous executive order declaring that children born to people who are in the United States illegally or temporarily are not American citizens. The Supreme Court struck down that attempt in June. Last month, the president tried again with a narrowed executive order that appeared to restrict automatic citizenship for specific categories of people, including children born to adults with connections to foreign embassies or organizations, or to anyone considered an alien enemy of the United States. The order also sought to deny citizenship to children born to adults who, quote, engaged in commercial transaction to purchase or access birthright citizenship. Some families said they feared their children could be denied citizenship simply because they purchased airfare to come to the U.S. and got pregnant after they arrived. Other families and organizations who sued over the birthright citizenship restrictions told the court that the executive branch has taken a broad view of who qualifies as an alien enemy, sometimes relying on speculation or misinformation to make that determination. There were also concerns that some children would be denied citizenship because a member of their parents' extended family was connected to a gang in their home country, even though the parents were not themselves gang members. In her ruling yesterday, Boardman wrote, quote, "The Supreme Court has spoken. Children in the certified class are citizens at birth." Billionaire investor Leon Black refused to appear for a sworn deposition before Congress today and instead sued the House Oversight Committee, asking a federal court to block subpoenas issued as part of its investigation into disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein. The House Oversight Committee served Black with two subpoenas during a closed-door voluntary interview in June after a lawmaker said he refused to answer questions about non-disclosure agreements. One subpoena demanded Black produce non-disclosure agreements and other documents, while the other compelled him to return for a deposition before the committee. Black is the co-founder and former chief executive of the private equity firm Apollo Global Management. He stepped down in 2021 during the fallout over his ties to Epstein. Lawmakers have alleged that Black paid Epstein $180 million during their years-long relationship. A review commissioned by Apollo found that Black paid Epstein $158 million from 2012 to 2017. After Epstein pleaded guilty in 2008 to soliciting prostitution from a minor. The review said the payments were for, quote, bona fide tax, estate planning, and other related services. Black is among a number of influential figures to appear in the investigation into Epstein and the web of wealth and influence around him. Other figures to have appeared for the investigation include former Democratic President Bill Clinton, Commerce Secretary Howard Lutnick, and Microsoft co-founder Bill Gates. Black is mentioned repeatedly in files that the Justice Department has released related to the Epstein investigation. He also appears in a collection of birthday messages sent to Epstein that were released by the House Committee last year, including a poem attributed to Black that refers to, quote, blonde, red, or brunette spread out geographically. Black's lawsuit argues the subpoenas exceed the committee's authority by seeking private information unrelated to Epstein or any legitimate legislative purpose. It asks a federal judge to declare the subpoenas invalid and prevent the committee from enforcing them. In a statement, Black's lawyer called the committee's order a, quote, fishing expedition. The top Republican and Democratic lawmakers on the committee both criticized Black's lawsuit and said they plan to discuss whether they could hold him in contempt of Congress. Republican House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer called Black's actions unacceptable.
We're very disappointed. I don't think I need to tell anyone in here how important of a witness Mr. Black is to this investigation.
Democratic Representative Suhas Subramaniam insisted that despite Black's actions, the committee would be speaking to him.
All we're asking from him is to sit down with our committee and offer us basic information and basic documents that we've asked of most other people as well. And he is not providing that. He's not giving us what we are asking for. And we are Congress, and so we are not one of his clients. We are not one of his friends. We are Congress, and so he has to be responsive to us. And he can try to sue us, but we're just doing our job, which is to get transparency and accountability that the American people want.
Being held in contempt of Congress could open Black up as a witness to open up Black to criminal prosecution. I'm Scott Baba. You're listening to the Pacifica Evening News. We'll be back with more after this.
Coming up this week on LA Theater Works,
a poor Sicilian widow is raising her only daughter in post-war Louisiana.
Oh, Madonna, Madonna, speak in here. Please, lady, I can't hear you. Is this a sign?
Mercedes Rule and Anthony LaPaglia star in The Rose Tattoo by Tennessee Williams. Next time on LA Theater Works.
That's this Sunday evening from 10 p.m. until midnight. L.A. Theater Works right here on KPFK.
Hi, this is Halle Berry, and you're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM.
President Trump today promised to help Republican lawmakers running in this year's midterm elections. He said running on his record is a surefire winner despite his sagging poll numbers. Democrats say voters will remember his broken promise to take on affordability. Max Pringle has more.
Trump hosted a White House Rose Garden dinner today with GOP leaders. He pledged to campaign for Republicans in all the roughly three dozen contests that are likely to determine control of Congress.
I'm going to go to every one of those 35 places, and we're going to see if we can get everyone elected. You know, I think it's worked. Then we're going to do the teletown halls. They're fantastic. They work amazingly, and we speak, and we can do 7 or 8 of them, 10 of them, maybe a night. And we're going to really work hard.
Voters' dim views of the economy and the war in Iran have put Republicans in a tough spot as the midterms loom in just about 2 months. Trump told his party's most vulnerable lawmakers that they had a triumphant story to tell voters by attaching themselves to his accomplishments. He pointed to his economic numbers.
The stock market has hit 80 all-time record highs in just a year and a half. Think of that. So it's at 80 all-time record highs since the election. American exports are at the all-time high. So exporting, that's a good thing because you're making it and you're exporting it. We're manufacturing things, in other words, again. So they're at the highest they've ever been, exports.
Trump also claimed that he's winning the Iran war.
We now control the Hormuz Strait. And we have many boats going through that every day, every night. Many, many boats loaded up with oil. And so far, I don't want to speak too bravely, too foolishly, but so far they've done very little to be able to stop it.
However, the facts tell a different story. The number of vessels transiting the Strait of Hormuz are down to single digits from the hundreds before the war started in February, and the war remains a source of deep dissatisfaction with Americans. House Democratic leader Hakeem Jeffries told reporters that the country is not buying the president's story.
The economy under Donald Trump and Republicans is a disaster. It continues to move in the wrong direction. The decisions that have been made, like this reckless and costly war of choice in Iran, have been a failure. and it's time for dramatic change.
Jeffries stood between two posters. One read that families have spent $3,800 more on goods and services under Trump. The other read that gas prices have gone from an average $2.98 per gallon before the Iran war to $4.14 per gallon now. Jeffries says that's because Trump and the Republicans have not made affordability a priority.
If you have people in high office in this town who are so focused on enriching themselves, their family members, and their donors, that means they're not focused on making life better for everyday Americans.
Trump talked up economic investment in the United States and lower drug prices using significantly inflated figures, as well as diminished border crossings. The midterm election is Tuesday, November 3rd. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
An Immigration and Customs Enforcement officer at the center of a dispute between Minnesota, Texas, and the federal government is in custody after federal prosecutors charged him with allegedly lying to investigators about the shooting of a Venezuelan man during an immigration crackdown in Minneapolis. A person familiar with the case says Christian Castro is charged with making false statements to federal investigators. The charges remain under seal. Castro, who turned himself in today, is accused of shooting Julio Cesar Sosa Celis in the leg during a January confrontation. Federal authorities initially accused Sosa Celis of another man and another man of attacking an officer with a broom handle and a snow shovel. But video evidence raised questions about that account, and federal prosecutors later dropped the charges against the men. Minnesota prosecutors have separately already charged Castro with assault and falsely reporting a crime. Castro was arrested in May and held in Texas while Minnesota sought his extradition. He was released last week after Texas Republican Governor Greg Abbott declined to sign his extradition papers, citing unrelated federal fraud probes in Minnesota, and a federal judge declined to order Texas to surrender him. Castro was suspended without pay by ICE in February. The federal investigation is continuing, and prosecutors have not made a federal final decision on... A whistleblower at U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement warned that the agency was lowering hiring standards as it rapidly added thousands of officers for President Donald Trump's immigration crackdown. The former unit chief in ICE's Office of Professional Responsibility said the agency was making final job offers before completing basic background checks, including fingerprinting, identity verification, and credit checks. In an August 2025 memo, the official called it a, quote, unprecedented lowering of standards and warned of increased risks of insider threats, infiltration, and misconduct. The whistleblower complaint was obtained by the Associated Press after the New York Times first reported on it this morning. The official, a longtime ICE employee who has since retired, asked the Department of Homeland Security's Inspector General to investigate the vetting failures. ICE announced in January that it had hired 12,000 new officers in less than a year, backed by a $75 billion congressional investment and a $50,000 signing bonus. The rapid hiring has raised concerns about whether recruits are being adequately screened and trained. The AP previously found some new hires had financial problems, allegations of misconduct, or troubled employment histories. ICE said today that the whistleblower no longer works for the agency and that it continues to follow required personnel vetting rules. The inspector general is investigating ICE's hiring and training practices. Tribal members and activists are continuing tree sits, blockades, and prayer camps at several points along the U.S.-Mexico border in Arizona to resist the Trump administration's border wall expansion, which they say amounts to ecocide and violates tribal sovereignty. in the Tohono O'odham Nation, southwest of Tucson. The Trump administration is proposing a roughly 60-mile border wall that tribal leaders say could block more than 3,000 O'odham people living on the Mexico side from reaching the reservation and critical services their lives depend on. The proposed wall also threatens sacred sites, including Cuitabaquito Springs, home to endemic and endangered fish and turtles found nowhere else in the world. Tohono O'odham Nation Chairman Verlin Jose says the project is a waste of taxpayers' money that does not provide real security, while continuing long-standing harms to Native people, tribal sovereignty, and the environment. KPFA's Lauren Schmidt is reporting from the ground and joined Chairman Jose for a tour of the borderlands to show the world what is at stake if the project moves forward.
We are the Tohono O'odham Nation. We are the people of this land. We've always been here. We haven't been forced and removed to other areas to live on. We've always been here.
Traditional Tohono O'odham territory stretched from what is now central Arizona south into Sonora, Mexico, and west towards the Gulf of California. Their homelands long predate and have always extended across what is now the U.S.-Mexico border. Today, the Tohono O'odham Nation encompasses roughly 2.8 million acres, an area about the size of Connecticut, about 65 miles west of Tucson. For generations, there was no border wall dividing O'odham communities. O'odham communities and sacred sites remain on both sides of that boundary, with long-standing cultural, familial, and ceremonial ties extending into what is now Mexico. But that landscape has changed dramatically as the U.S. government has increasingly fortified the border, further cutting off the tribe's community, and for its 3,000 citizens who live on the Mexico side of the proposed wall, it would mean to enter the nation hundreds of miles and hundreds of dollars, now having to apply for an I-94 permit costing $1,000.
We don't have $1,000. It's even hard for our members, just people in Mexico, to even have $100. So it's very difficult. And so it got a little bit more difficult for our members to cross. We still cross here. Some of our members who are regulars here, they are allowed to cross. But the other thing is at the discretion of the agent, too.
Chairman Jose, what will happen to the 3,000 registered members if the wall goes through? How will they access health care? What would that look like for them?
They won't have, in our Constitution, if they're, and these are federally, we're a federally recognized tribe, and they've met all the requirements to be members of the nation, as it is right now, they won't have health care.
But even without the wall, other members are currently afraid to come, despite it being their birthright.
And right now, even our members are afraid to come because of the harassment through ICE and everything else. Even they're here for just official business with the nation. That they could be deported and then they could be on a list that's banned for 10 years. So an elder tried to walk through the wash here to walk to the ranch to get a ride. So they apprehended him and they deported him back to Mexico. They released him in Nogales. This guy doesn't speak English. He speaks a little bit of Spanish, but he just speaks O'odham. And he had no money. And Nogales might not seem far to some people if you have money and you have a vehicle. To him, that was a whole world away. And he had to somehow manage to catch a ride to the next town, catch a ride to the next town. And finally, after probably a week later, made it back home. But this is an elder out there, you know, lost out there. And bad things happen out there, you know. So we'll have to go through that. But that's why we have to go through it, because of this political ploy to build these barriers here that separate our people, separate our families, separate our members.
In addition to the concerns for the living, The same exists for the dead, as remains are located along the proposed site, and the chairman says some have already been desecrated, despite strict federal laws that should protect against such incidents.
These mountains, and they wanted to build a road here, and the people said no, because there are burials here. There are areas here that is known to the people that is not known to everybody. And if you go, it's going to happen exactly like what happened at Monument Hill. They knew Monument Hill out there, they knew that that was sacred sites. They knew that there were archaeological evidence there and that there were burial sites there. And they still blew through that whole mountain. You know what our folks had to do? They had to go out there and collect pieces of bones that they saw out there. How would you like to go and pick pieces of your family up? How would you like it if I went to your cemeteries and I blew it up and you had to go pick up the remains of your relatives and they weren't whole? That is so sad and so disrespectful, and it's traumatizing.
The Tohono O'odham chairman expressed deep frustration, saying he met with CBP Commissioner Rodney Scott, with DHS Secretary Mark Wayne Mullen, the first native to fill that position, and he says they have gone back on their word or expressed the need to proceed for political gain, something multiple tribal members described as disgusting and disturbing. They note that it has cooperated with federal border security agencies for decades. And they note that there is already a significant federal security presence on the nation, including two forward operating bases and border patrol operations, along with a network of surveillance technology. That includes integrated fixed towers and mobile surveillance towers manufactured by Israeli defense contractor Elbit Systems. For them, it feels like a spit in the face.
Commissioner Scott calls me and says, "Oh, yeah, we just put that out there, but we're just thinking about just building one." Yeah. How many times have I heard your forked tongue? How many times has the U.S. government told us something and went against it? I don't have to tell you. History can tell you for itself.
Chairman Jose, the Big Bend project was halted, will be halted, and they're saying that they're going to use some of the technologies you say is already here in the nation. Why do you think that's a solution for Big Bend and not a solution for this stretch in your nation?
Political. It is political. It's political because, exactly as you stated, everything that they're saying here, we're already doing here. And that's why I said, why are my prayers not important? Why is my place of worship not important? Why is my religion not important? Why? Because in Texas, in a national park, where they have, well, not that I'm aware of, have no legal backing from building on there. Not like the Tohono Nation, where the Congress has, so you can diminish it. We have some law behind that, and they're allowing to put a pause there, but not here. Why? Look at the graphics. What's it, like 11 sheriffs that have come up and oppose it? There are 10, 11 sheriffs that come up and oppose it. Their senators, their representatives, their federal senators and representatives have voted. Some of their state elected officials. Their governor came out and opposed it. You know, there's strong opposition to it. And that's why. Why? Because the guy up there knows that he's losing his footprint on his political base and is concerned about that. Well, let's go send the number two guy, the number three guy over there. Let's see what they can do to work something out. You know, let's put a pause in that. The Tohono Nation, we don't matter to them. It's going back to what I said before. You try to erase the Native Americans from this country. Not on our watch.
But when asked about the concerns of drugs and human trafficking, he responded,
"My response to that, look at the numbers. Look at the years of cooperation and unification of addressing border issues. On their own numbers, they indicate that the apprehensions are down by 95%. If you look at www.whitehouse.gov, they talk about having control of the border and redirecting enforcement and working together to reduce those numbers. I forget what the language is on there. But just go there and look at that. So the president or whoever is running his web page is saying, hey, we got control of the border. We reassess some resources and we're working together with the state, federal, and local, and you know, it's the numbers are going down. So that's working.
While the tribe is not asking non-tribal members to participate in direct action, Chairman Jose said he wants to make the public aware that sacred sites are currently being desecrated. KPFA will continue to bring you coverage from the ground. You can see photos and videos on our social media and our previous reports at kpfa.org. The Missouri Supreme Court unanimously blocked new congressional districts backed by President Donald Trump from being used in November, ordering a statewide referendum before the map can take effect. The court ruled that Republican Secretary of State Denny Hoskins wrongly rejected a citizen petition seeking a vote on the new districts, writing, quote, the referendum petition was legal, sufficient, and timely, and the secretary incorrectly concluded otherwise. Until voters approve the map, the state's prior congressional boundaries drawn after the 2020 census will remain in effect for November. The Republican-led legislature redrew the map last year at President Trump's urging, targeting the district held by Democratic Congressman Emanuel Cleaver of Kansas City. Opponents submitted more than 300,000 petition signatures seeking a public vote. Cleaver has said he'll keep campaigning regardless of the outcome. Meanwhile, the Maryland Supreme Court ruled today that voters in that state will get to decide in November on a congressional redistricting amendment being pushed by Democrats, reversing two lower court rulings that had blocked it from going to voters. The court wrote that the proposed constitutional amendment must be placed on the November ballot, but the court directed the contested ballot summary to be rewritten. Lower courts had ruled that lawmakers didn't abide by their own requirements when referring the amendment to the ballot and had missed certain deadlines. Republican lawmakers had won in lower courts on claims that the ballot question wording was misleading and that the amendment violated a single-issue requirement in the state constitution by including a provision giving original jurisdiction over congressional redistricting lawsuits to the state Supreme Court. The court rejected the multiple subject argument, but concurred that the ballot wording was misleading. However, the court said that wasn't enough to prevent the amendment from going to the people. It instead directed the amendment to go forward with a change to be made to the wording that voters will see. The rulings mark a rare setback for Republicans in a broader national mid-decade redistricting push initiated by President Donald Trump spanning more than a dozen states. The U.S. House passed a Republican-backed bill that would penalize universities that participate in boycotts of Israel. The Protect Economic and Academic Freedom Act passed today by a vote of 237 to 169, with 33 Democrats joining Republicans in support. Two Republicans voted against it, while the bill now goes to the Senate. The measure would require colleges receiving federal student aid to certify that they do not participate in boycotts of Israel. It also would require schools receiving federal funding for international study and foreign language programs to certify that they do not restrict students from participating in programs in Israel or Israeli students from studying on their campuses. Republican supporters say the bill would combat anti-Semitism and prevent discrimination against Israeli students and institutions. Democrats opposing the measure say it could infringe on First Amendment protections for political protest. Democratic Representative Joaquin Castro of Texas noted that the bill would force schools and students to support West Bank settlements, even as settler violence against Palestinians has this year risen to its highest level ever recorded.
If this House should be debating anything on this issue, it should be sanctions on these settlements, not a bill that protects them. And let me lay out a scenario so that we understand exactly how this piece of legislation would work. If a university in Texas decided tomorrow to stop doing business with a company in South Carolina or California or Idaho, it would face no consequences under American law. But make the same decision about Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank, and this bill strips American students of their Pell Grants and American veterans of their hard-earned benefits. This bill holds American students' education hostage to protect a foreign government.
Castro also noted the bill is in direct violation of the Constitution.
In the landmark decision, NAACP versus Claiborne Hardware, the Supreme Court held that a politically motivated boycott is protected expression under the First Amendment. This isn't an obscure case. It is the reason the sponsors of the bill wrote the word, quote unquote, non-expressive into the text. Yet, every example the sponsors point to is plainly political. A boycott is a political act. It is protected under the First Amendment. And you don't have to even agree with the boycott to support an American's right to engage in it.
The bill's sponsor, Republican Representative Virginia Fox of North Carolina, said that the bill is necessary to fight anti-Semitism.
Commercial and academic boycotts like the ones we see when fueled by taxpayer funds represent concrete discrimination against the people's national origin. They are discriminating against people of the Jewish faith. They result in discrimination against and marginalizing of Israeli students. No matter how you slice it, these anti-Semitic boycotts should have no place in higher education and deserve zero intersection with the federal government.
But Democratic Representative Bobby Scott of Virginia was skeptical about how much Republicans actually care about anti-Semitism.
Recall when President Trump declared that there were fine people on both sides when a bunch of white supremacists in their Unite the Right rally marched to the University of Virginia's campus chanting, "Jews will not replace us." My colleagues on the other side were also silent as numerous reports regarding chapters of the College Republicans openly promoted their hatred of Jewish people among other groups. And all the while this has been going on, my colleagues have not told the president to stop firing lawyers at the Office of Civil Rights at the Department of Education, the agency responsible for investigating claims of anti-Semitism in education. My colleagues on the other side of the aisle are certainly mum about how this administration is dismissing Title VI disparate impact analysis, the very tool necessary to address practices and policies that may appear facially neutral, but in fact discriminate against protected classes under the law.
Democratic Representative Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey co-sponsored the bill, which comes as Democrats remain divided over U.S. support for Israel and its military campaign in Gaza heading into the midterms. Feminist icon Gloria Steinem has died. She was 92. The former journalist and author co-founded Ms. Magazine and was a leading voice of the American women's movement in the 1960s and 70s. Steinem spoke out for gender equality on the page, on frequent television and radio interviews on college campuses, and at rallies. At a rally in New York in 2019, Steinem said today's feminist leaders can learn from leaders of the past.
Feminists too often believe that no one has ever experienced the kind of society that empowered women and made that empowerment the basis of rules and civilization. The price the feminist community must pay because it is unaware is confusion, division, and much lost time.
Steinem's death was announced on social media yesterday. She died at her New York City home. She began her career as a journalist, notably one who reported in 1963 on degrading conditions in Hugh Hefner's Playboy Empire, an undercover assignment she came to later regret. She credits a meeting 6 years later where women spoke out boldly in favor of abortion rights with changing her career path. She remained active, traveling and speaking well into her 80s. Bay Area weather this evening, mostly cloudy before clearing a little to partly cloudy with a slight chance of rain, lows in the upper 50s. Mostly cloudy tomorrow morning before clearing to sunny, highs in the upper 60s to mid 70s. In the Central Valley,
many
mostly clear tonight with lows in the low 60s.
Possible,
sunny tomorrow.
Each giving what they can to help ensure the station's future. One way to help is by donating land or other property that you no longer need. Learn more about the advantages to KPFK and to you of donating real estate at KPFK.org.